Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour program looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday, 4:30 to 5 p.m.
Dave, hello and welcome to Europe on Air. Over the course of this series, we have been looking at aspects of Irish society in a European context. And today, we will be considering Ireland and Europe after World War II. And my guests are John Dorney, historian, author and co-presenter of Near FM's Irish History Show, Peter Cunningham, the treasurer of the Near Media Co-op, and Jonathan Claridge, head of political section in the European Commission office in Dublin. So, gentlemen, you're all very welcome. Ireland had an emergency and Europe had a war. But let's get straight into some of the more serious matters at hand. The after effects of World War II and the role that the Cold War played in European integration in the West, but then the separation and of the East. John Dorney, let me bring you in there first.
Mm-hmm. The Second World War, it goes without saying, was the most catastrophic conflict in human history and certainly in Europe's history. And it's difficult to imagine the devastation all across Europe, from Holland or Netherlands where there was a famine, right across to Eastern Europe where there'd been genocide, right across to the eastern borders of Europe in Russia and Poland, Belarus, Ukraine. And there was a sense in Europe, I think, of really this time never again. People had said never again after the First World War, but for real this time, never again. So, and I think in the kind of official narrative of the EU, that's certainly the version that the European Union emerged as an alternative to conflict. I think, though, also, if you're being realistic, you also have to look at the EU emerging in the context of the Cold War, in the context of the split of Europe between East and West, how it was divided up between the superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. And you have to look, I think, at the early European Union, the European Coal and Steel Community and the European Economic Community, as essentially, first of all, a condition of the Marshall Plan. The Americans wanted European competition or European cooperation so that the Marshall Plan would work effectively, so that the Western European economy would grow and would revive. And the NATO came out slightly after the first European Union integration. But I think you have to look at all these things in the same context, that it's true that European countries, there was a sense we have to work together, we have to put conflict in the past. There was also a sense, well, we have a new threat in the Soviet-dominated, the communist East. So I think that there are, if you like, idealistic reasons for the start of European integration, and there are also practical reasons.
So how did we get an East and West? Is it as simple as the Americans were advancing, the Allies on one side and the Russians on the other, and kind of where they stopped, they drew the line?
I'd probably bow to John's greater historical knowledge on that, but I would have thought, you know, from my own readings on this, that there was... it was a very random split of we need to stop this, we need to stop this now, therefore let's draw a line. You take what's on this side of the line and I'll take what's on that side of the line. And out of that emerged, I suppose, what we do know is the Iron Curtain and two competing, I suppose, superpowers, two competing superpowers within the European area, one which aligned itself to the US, and I suppose the support that it gave through the emergence of NATO and other American-backed organisations. And then The opposing side of the magnet then would have been, I suppose, the Russian Empire as it emerged.
I mean, the original traditional Cold War line was that basically the Cold War developed because the Soviets wanted to dominate Europe and take over the world for communism. And it's not without truth, because that was, of course, the ideology of the Comintern prior to the Second World War. But increasingly, the kind of historical consensus is that Stalin's strategy was to create a buffer zone between the Soviet Union and Western Europe and Germany. Because who knows, Germany could revive in the future, and to create what he called a cordon sanitaire for the Soviet Union. It looks like initially the Soviet plan was to put public governments in some countries, like Poland, for example, but not in other countries. So, for example, Czechoslovakia originally had elections after the Second World War. That lasted only until 1948, when the Soviets basically staged a coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia. But one of the interesting things is that some countries which were within the Soviet orbit, and Austria is the best example, actually were allowed to be non-aligned and to be multi-party. So there is a sense also that the Soviets felt threatened by certain American actions, which, I mean, in hindsight, look, some of them look benign, like, for example, the Marshall Plan, which was aid to Western Europe. What how the Soviets viewed this was as an attempt to rebuild what they saw as Western capitalist powers as a potential threat to them. And the other thing the Americans did at the end of the Second World War, or that was impossible to negotiate, was a loan from the United States to the Soviet Union to rebuild the war damage. And that created a lot of bad blood as well. So the modern historians, I want to stress I'm not an expert in this period, but modern historians do tend to feel that there was blame on both sides for the start of the Cold War.
Jonathan, would you like to come in on that?
Yeah, I think the European Union, if you look back at it, since it started with coal and steel cooperation, as we heard earlier, it's grown over time into agriculture, environment, economics, politics, status of women, and it's had a very influential role in securing stability and prosperity in Europe in a way that's been unheard of in the past. You know, we've had the conflicts, you've had the wars in the past with the European Union. We've seen that it's actually been a very effective force. And so it's almost inconceivable these days that you could have a war between the member states of the European Union. So I think it has played a very big role. And I think also when you turn to the end of the Cold War and what happened after that, what happened to the member states, the European Union can be seen as a very influential player. You know, when the former Soviet Union broke up, what was going to happen to the former parts of the former Soviet Union? And the European Union, by anchoring a lot of those countries inside the European Union, in Europe, democratic, with human rights, with sound legal systems, it's really helped secure the future and stability of a broader Europe.
Peter, you're of an age, and for the people who can't see Peter, he's old enough to remember the Berlin Wall and that time. I mean, could you have imagined that places like Poland would be part of the European Union and it would be the most widely spoken second language in Ireland? And or was that beyond our imagination?
Well,
1989?
I think it was probably beyond most people's imagination. The events of the collapse of the Iron Curtain were extremely sudden for people of, I suppose I would have been a teen at the time, but for people in there even more so who would have lived in the aftermath of World War II, to see a time whereby people were clamouring to get over the Berlin Wall, and the scenes that we saw then were absolutely, they were unprecedented. We should never see the likes again. As Jonathan said, the idea of having a war in Europe between member states is utterly inconceivable. And I suppose there is a view, probably correctly, that the EU and Western Europe represents prosperity. It represents a degree, at least, of wealth. It represents media freedom, represents freedom of speech. And that's what the view would be, that's what these people were searching for. That's what they were declined during the years that they were, I suppose, under the influence, as would be said, of the Eastern Bloc.
And I suppose on the topic, and Jonathan mentioned it too, I mean, the European powers, the great European powers, were constantly at war throughout the medieval period. I'm sure the English and the Dutch were never done fighting, especially their navies and stuff. But that's so inconceivable now that something like that could possibly happen. I mean, the EU was given the Nobel Prize for Peace. Was that merited?
Yeah, I think it's a recognition. It was given in 2012, which marks 50 years, I guess, since the first foundation of the European Union. And it was 50 years of peace and prosperity, something that, you know, was hard to imagine not that long ago. And I think it reflects the fact that now in Europe, when there's a problem, we don't go to war, we don't send in the tanks, we don't send in the army. What we do, we sit around a table and we talk and we find a compromise. It might not be perfect, but it's a much better way of doing things than the way that things were done in the past. And I think it's a recognition of that massive change that's happened in Europe, and which I don't think we should lose sight of today. It's very important, the role there.
I mean, although I agree with that, and I think the European Union has been a great influence, I think that we also have to be hard-headed about this. I mean, why wasn't there a war in Western Europe during the Cold War? Because of the Cold War, because these countries were allies against the Soviet Union. And today, yes, we cooperate in trade and so forth, and I agree that this is very good. But if you look at the fringes of the EU and Ukraine, you have a traditional problem, really, which is, you know, one state, in this case Russia, trying to dominate another state, a traditional European thing to do, and the other state doesn't want to be dominated, and hence there's a war, in the case a proxy war. The European Union got away with not having a military policy like a traditional European state, because in some ways the EU now operates as a kind of a European state in some respects. Like certainly it negotiates collectively about Ukraine, for example, but it doesn't have the military option. It got away with not having that because of NATO and the Cold War. It seems to me that like we don't have no wars in Europe because we became better people. It's just, but you know, it's the force of events. I think it's a very fortunate and good course of events. It doesn't mean it's going to last forever, unfortunately. I mean, there will still be, we do see wars already around the periphery of the EU. We may in the future. And while I wouldn't be crazy about the idea of militarized Europe, it does beg the question of what are we going to do about these conflicts if they do break out.
If the primary goal of setting up the EEC or the, well, as it was the EEC under the Treaty of Rome, was to create a peaceful, harmonious continent, or at least those member states within that group, it has achieved that. So from that point of view, you could say that the Nobel Prize was well merited. Other people might say that it was actually a lack of imagination, and there mightn't have been any great alternatives at the time.
And was the Balkan Wars 20 years ago such a shock to that system, because it was clearly on mainland Europe and on the Austrian border almost, but definitely not the modern European, not the EU as part of the EU. Was that something that demonstrated how well the EU had done, or demonstrated how weak the EU was to do anything about it?
Or how inevitable the war in the Balkans was, maybe, instead, because very few countries actually do break up peaceably. I think the Czech Republic and Slovakia would be an exception.
I mean, I think the Yugoslav wars, though, again, in a way that's a bit similar to the Ukraine crisis, showed how well the EU had done, but also sort of how naive it was. I mean, like, it was unable to enforce a solution, as European powers traditionally did in the Balkans. If you go back to before the First World War, which all ended very badly, but that was an attempt by the Austrians to enforce their solution on the Balkans. The European Union didn't have a military option, and the wars in Yugoslavia went on and on, and eventually it was NATO which managed to enforce a compromise. But when the Yugoslav wars broke out in 1991, when Croatia seceded from Yugoslavia, the EU, it was just about the EU. Well, it was still the EC at the time. It was the EU the following year. The Germans and the EU voted, okay, well, Croatia wants to be independent, so the Germans recognised Croatia. And they seemed to have this idea that, well, we'll get these new, you know, these new Europeans, they're learning about democracy, we'll get them together and they'll talk, and they'll see reason, because like us, they'll be reasonable people, they'll become better people. And it just didn't work like that, unfortunately. Power politics requires force, which is a terrible thing to say.
Jonathan?
I think if you move on and to more recent years, I think, you know, the story in the Balkans is pretty positive as far as Europe's concerned. Slovenia has been a member of the European Union for some time. Croatia joined last year, becoming the 28th member state. You have Serbia and Albania, they're candidate countries, so that means they're in the process of negotiating membership of the EU. It might take some time. It's a very tough process to go through. But I think now you can really see Europe helping bring stability to the Balkan region.
I suppose the Balkans are a particular case, but maybe looking at other more recent members, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the accession of new states from Eastern Europe, how did that play out? Was that again, were they running into the arms of the EU? The Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, those kind of places?
Well, they were. I mean, I think it's one of the most positive things the EU has tried to bring to the former communist countries is a fundamental rule of law, and to try to halt corruption. And if you look at, for example, again, Ukraine, this is one of the things the Ukrainians are most keen about, why many Ukrainians would like to join the EU, because of this idea that they would put a rein on corruption to some extent. I wonder, again, I must sound very cynical, but I wonder if, again, it's naive to think that the European Union will solve these problems immediately, because you have decades of authoritarianism and so forth to deal with. But I think certainly that's a positive thing that the EU has tried to do. If it's successful in all countries, I don't know.
And have those Eastern European countries, the big countries like Poland and smaller countries like Estonia and places, have they settled in easily and become part of the EU as their European partners?
Yeah, I think from the European Commission, the European Union has always been quite an attractive place to come from. We shouldn't lose sight. It started off with 6 member states. We're now up to 28. There's more countries knocking on the door wanting to come in. And with regard to the countries that joined in 2004, the 10 member states, that was the big enlargement. yeah, they're fully part. It still works, the European Union. How does it work with 28 member states sitting around a table? You know, it's a big negotiation, but it has worked remarkably well, I think. You know, they've benefited in many ways from the transfers to them, the structural funds, the common agricultural policy that Ireland knows very well. They've benefited from that. For Ireland, it's been able to benefit from a bigger market, more opportunities to sell its goods. You know, we've seen the Polish people come into Ireland, Irish people going elsewhere. So it's gone remarkably well, I think.
But has, I mean, when Kieran asked the question, how has it worked for countries like Poland? Like, there would nearly be an impression that people are fleeing Poland over the last 10, 15 years. The Polish population, at least in Ireland, anyway, is enormous compared to what it would have been prior to their membership of the EU. So how could we say that it's worked for Poland when, you know, people are leaving Poland? I know it's a very general thing to say, but...
Yeah, Kieran mentioned before, I think, about Polish being a very big language here. And one thing that struck me, I'm a Brit, being in Dublin for 3 years, but when I arrived, I discovered there was more Polish people living in Ireland than British people, which I just found quite extraordinary, a surprising fact. I think what you did see, though, during the crisis here, and Poland has been actually performing remarkably well, is a lot of Polish people actually begin to go back to Poland. And so, you know, people will kind of follow the economic... There's a freedom now in Europe to go where the jobs are, to go where the growth is. And, you know, Ireland has suffered a lot during the crisis and had emigration of people, but you've been able to see people move around, and the freedom in Europe to move around and get jobs has been a positive thing that's helped them bed in.
Let me pick up on that point, and it has grown from 6 to 28, and lots of countries want to become members, so let's make an assumption that it is a positive place, the EU. But what happens then with places like Catalan and like Scotland, who seem to want more independence or more separateness? How does that fit with the European model?
I think the big problem with that is that the European Union as yet is not, it's still not a state or even a confederation. The European Union is still the sum of its parts politically. So a country like Spain, for example, much more than the UK actually, is never going to recognise Catalonia or the Basque Country, for that matter, as independent. And for that matter, they're never going to recognise Kosovo either, because of the implications in Spain. So the European Union is never going to unilaterally recognise a secession from a member state, I don't think. And if it did, it would cause serious political problems. I wouldn't say war or anything of that nature, but certainly it would cause possible secession from the European Union, I would say, from a member state. So it looks to me like it's going to be a big disincentive to secede from Scotland or Catalonia.
I'd have thought that the European Union needs a period of consolidation coming out of the turmoil. I know it was primarily economic turmoil, but still coming out of the turmoil of the last 5 years, it needs to consolidate. It needs to show stability, economic stability and growth. At the end of the day, what matters to most people, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, is what's in their pocket. So I think it needs a period of consolidation before it does consider a period of expansion.
Yeah, I think from my side, sometimes the European Commission is accused of meddling in things too much. But this is one issue where we don't meddle. We say this issue, it's for the member states, it's the countries to decide. So we keep our noses well out of that one.
Maybe rather than in a specific political sense, but in a more cultural sense, I mean, we can't exactly speak for Basques or Scots or something. But in breaking away from their mother country, if I can use that term, are they still European? Are they saying that they want to be part of the EU? Let's take Scotland, for example, as our nearest neighbour. But so we have an independent Scotland, but are they stepping back from the United Kingdom or are they stepping back from the European Union?
Well, Alex Salmond and the Scottish Nationalist Party have certainly said they want to be part of the EU, and so have the Catalans, for that matter. In fact, it was kind of a condition of them becoming independent. So what you're seeing, at the moment anyway, what you're seeing among minority nationalities is very pro-European stance. On the other hand, though, I mean, if you talk about, it's not kind of quite the same sort of nationalism. You do see parties in, there's far-right parties across Europe, but especially in places like Hungary, which are becoming quite anti-European. And while they're not in power, they do kind of influence the centre-right parties who are in power. So, kind of, as opposed to like minority nationalism, but kind of state nationalism, there is some feeling among relatively new member states which is against the European Union. Why that is, I'm not really sure, but there seems to be some sort of backlash to some extent.
Peter, you were just on holiday in Catalonia.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Catalans, are they a people who want to be less Spanish but more European?
Well, I spent most of my holiday in a resort, unfortunately, with more Irish and British people than Catalans. But yes, I did speak to some, obviously, as you do when you're over there. And it's a confusing topic because, you know, they do see themselves as extremely Spanish. When Spain is playing in the World Cup as it was, then they'd be very supportive of Spain. I think there's too much of trying to differentiate between your own nationality and, you know, this notion of European citizenship or whatever it is. You can be both. You can be both Irish and European, and one doesn't have to override the other. But at the end of the day, I suppose your own national origin or country of origin will inevitably, I suppose, override. But one doesn't have to, I suppose, be an overlord of another. So because Catalans might want independence for their own cultural purposes, it doesn't mean that economically they don't want to be linked to a bigger union which might benefit them, I suppose, materially as well, because that doesn't have to diminish their own cultural heritage.
So you will have places perhaps outside of the more longer-term established European countries United Kingdom and Spain we were talking about, like the breakaway from Montenegro, from Serbia, those kind of places. Does that make it harder for them to be part of the European Union?
No, I think the European Union has members of many, many different sizes. I'm not sure which the smallest country is. Is it Luxembourg?
Cyprus.
I'm not sure.
Malta?
I don't. But Germany is the biggest, yeah. And so I think size doesn't matter so much.
But not even so much in the terms of the size of the country, but if there's more and more breakaway places, if the former Balkan states are looking for EU membership, but they keep subdividing, does that...
No, I think always for at least for the European Commission, accession of countries is judged on merit. They have to take on the European law, and that's it, basically. You know, it's a very tough thing to do, but it's not the size of a country. It's literally, you know, are you willing to reform? Are you willing to get your economy in order? How are human rights democratic? How's democracy operating? You know, it's really based on a very specific set of criteria, and the size of a country, I don't think it plays a part.
To switch the question back a little bit, coming out of the Second World War, as you were saying, John, it was such a massive and traumatic event in so many different ways, with so many deaths and stuff. But Ireland was largely untouched by that. As I start off by saying, we didn't call it a war, we called it an emergency. Mm. Does that set the Irish up as quite different in their response to the Second World War than to most other EU members?
Yeah, it's a short answer. But what's kind of interesting, though, is like we historically think of Ireland as a poor country. But actually, if you look at the figures, not only after the Second World War, but especially after the Second World War, because Ireland hadn't had the damage caused by the war, Ireland was actually way up there as per capita one of the richest countries. Now, it didn't feel that way. And people were leaving in their tens of thousands in the 40s and 50s. But Ireland applied for the Marshall Plan. And only got a little bit of it, which it had to pay back because the Americans said, you seem to be doing okay. Which is, it's a major difference between Irish experience and everyone else's experience, for sure. Whether it influences Irish attitudes to Europe, I'm not sure. Because as we were talking about off air, I think we're generally Irish attitudes are quite positive towards Europe. So, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that, gentlemen?
Yeah, no, I agree. I from my perspective, I think that Europe's had a big impact on Ireland, and Ireland's also had an impact on Europe. You know, issues on gender equality and the status of women. That's been one area where I think in 1973 there were no laws in Ireland about equality of women, equality. And that's changed completely these days. Issues on agriculture, the common agricultural policy. Ireland's had, I think, 50 billion euros of funds from the EU over the years. It's had a big impact here. Social funds, you know, the motorways in Ireland, which are sort of second to none. These have been a big thing from the European Union. And travel and holidays and cheap flights and cheap phone calls when you go on holiday to Catalonia. That's all stuff that Europe has helped on. And Ireland's had an impact on Europe as well, and not least, perhaps top of the pile, is the Irish presidencies of the EU. Every 6 months, a different country takes on the EU presidency. Ireland's last time was in the first half of last year, 2013. Fantastic presidency. It got all sorts of deals on agriculture, the budget, a youth guarantee. You know, it really did have, it has a stellar reputation, I think, within Europe for being a good and effective country that punches above its weight.
And is that possibly because there is a little bit of that outsider? Because coming out of the Second World War, we were quite different.
I was just going to say that.
I must admit, maybe just a minor kind of cultural kind of thing, but I was really caught out when almost all the countries I visited kind of in the interrailing years were all booing the German football team. I never booed the German football team. It didn't really occur to me. And yet we seem to be quite different. We can be out of step with a lot of European norms.
I was just going to say this exact thing. I mean, if you look at Greece, for example, like along with ourselves, the Greece obviously had a massive bailout from the European Union, but primarily from the Germans. But unlike us, the Greeks were brutally occupied by Germans during the Second World War. Like, incredibly brutally occupied. Like, just to take one example, the city of what we call in English Salonika, in Greece Thessaloniki, but the entire Jewish population, 50,000 people who had been there for, you know, for 300 years, were murdered. They were deported to Auschwitz and killed. And that was only one example, you know. So there is this history which probably helps Ireland that it doesn't have.
It doesn't have any baggage. We're almost out of time, but maybe just as a final comment, and you can just keep it fairly quick. Is the EU going in a continual upward curve? Is it going in a positive place? Will there be more new members? Will we have more and more of the European states in the years to come?
Why do we judge EU success on the number of members that it has?
Oh, not necessarily only that. Generally, with the current group and with the Smalling missing members of the European Union, the Norway's and Albania's and who else?
I would say for myself that the European Union needs to do a better job of selling itself, because it has to come now in the position of recovery after the turmoil over the last 5 years. And a lot of people do see it as having gone too far down the road of this single economic policy, the effects of cheap money over the last, say, 10 years in Europe, and how smaller countries have been treated in the turmoil over the last four or 5 years. So it needs to start reselling itself.
So economically, not doing so well.
It started off as a trade organisation. I mean, it was very successful as a trade organisation. It hasn't been successful as a single currency union.
Jonathan, socially and economically?
I think economically, that's kind of the big focus at the moment in Europe. You know, what's going to happen to the economy? Are we going to get more jobs? What can be done on that? And that's, I think, where the focus is going to be looking to the next few years. You know, over the last 5 years, the euro wobbled. That's not, you know, no one questions the euro now in some ways, but we've been through very painful times. You had some very tough decisions to make here in Ireland, and you know all too well, you know, with the unemployment and the emigration and the debt issues and the pain that you've gone through. But I think turning to the future, it's really, can Europe get a policy together where it can boost investment, boost growth, cooperate better on the economic front? And I think that will be the focus. There is room for optimism there. I think, you know, tough decisions have been made. The economy is picking up here. And the big challenge is now to make sure that we build on that economic recovery. And then I think we can be optimistic about the future.
And last word to you, John.
Okay, I have to make it quick, yeah? So I think that if Europe has to make decisions about what it's going to be, is it going to be a kind of a state, or is it going to be, as it is now, kind of some of its parts? If it is going to be a state, then it should be automatic, what's happening now, where the rich parts would pay for the poor parts in return for the single currency, in return for states not being allowed to devalue. Like in the United States, there's no question that, you know, New York is going to bail out Alabama. I'm just not phrased like that. If it's not going to be like that, that's okay, but hard decisions will have to be made in the next few years.
I'm not sure whether that's a positive or a negative note to end on. Thanks very much to my guests, John Dorney, Peter Cunningham and Jonathan Claridge. So that's all for this week, and that's all for the series. But the whole series is available on the Near FM podcast site, so please do have a listen. Thanks to my production team, in particular to Dorothy Meyer-Holtkamp and to Zandra Ball. Slán agus beannacht.
Europe on air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on air.
Europe on air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour programme looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday 4:30 to 5 p.m. Europe On Air radio campaign has been financed by the European Union. The contents of the radio shows reflect only the author's views, and the Commission is not responsible for any use that may be made of the information they contain.